one of his Playtex nursers, which he called Boggies. She could disguise the taste with chocolate milk. Little Walter loved chocolate milk. Accompanying the idea came the title of one of Phil's old record albums. Nothing matters, and what if it did? She pushed the idea away. I'm not that kind of mom, she told little Walter. He goggled up at her in a way that reminded her of Phil, but in a good way. The expression that only looked like puzzled stupidity on her estranged husband's face was endearingly goofy on her son's. She kissed his nose and he smiled. That was nice, a nice smile. But the band-aids on his forehead were turning red. That wasn't so nice.
Little change of plan, she said, and went back inside.
At first, she couldn't find the papoose, but finally spotted it behind what she would from now on think of as the rape couch. She finally managed to wriggle little Walter into it, although lifting him hurt her all over again. The dish wiper in her underwear was feeling ominously damp, but when she checked the crotch of her sweatpants, there were no spots. That was good.
Ready for a walk, little Walter?
Little Walter only snuggled his cheek into the hollow of her shoulder. Sometimes his paucity of speech bothered her. She had friends whose babies had been babbling whole sentences by 16 months, and little Walter only had 9 or 10 words. But not this morning. This morning she had other things to worry about. The day felt dismayingly warm for the last full week of October. The sky overhead was its very palest shade of blue, and the light was somehow blurry. She felt sweat spring out on her face and neck almost at once, and her crotch was throbbing badly, worse with every step, it seemed, and she had taken only a few. She thought of going back for aspirin, but wasn't it supposed to make bleeding worse? Besides, she wasn't sure she had any. There was something else as well, something she hardly dared admit to herself. If she went back into the house, she wasn't sure she'd have the heart to come back out again. There was a white scrap of paper under the Toyota's left windshield wiper. It had "Just a Note from Sammy" printed across the top and surrounded by daisies, torn from her own kitchen pad. The idea caused a certain tired outrage. Scrawled under the daisies was this: "Tell anyone and more than your tires will be flat." And below, in another hand, "Next time maybe we'll turn you over and play the other side."
"In your dreams, motherfucker," she said in a wan, tired voice.
She crumpled the note up, dropped it by one flat tire. Poor old Corolla looked almost as tired and sad as she felt, and made her way out to the end of the driveway, pausing to lean against the mailbox for a few seconds. The metal was warm on her skin, the sun hot on her neck, and hardly a breath of breeze. October was supposed to be cool and invigorating.
"Maybe it's that global warming stuff," she thought.
She was first to have this idea, but not the last. And the word which eventually stuck was not global, but local. Motton Road lay before her, deserted and charmless. Starting a mile or so to her left were the nice new homes of Eastchester, to which the mill's higher-class workadaddies and workamommies came at the end of their days in the shops and offices and banks of Lewiston Auburn. To her right lay downtown Chester's Mill and the health center.
"Ready, little Walter?"
Little Walter didn't say if he was or wasn't. He was snoring in the hollow of her shoulder and drooling on her Dawn of the Buffalo t-shirt. Sammy took a deep breath, tried to ignore the throb coming from the land down under, hitched up the papoose, and started toward town. When the whistle started up on top of the town hall, blowing the short blast that indicated a fire, she first thought it was in her own head, which was feeling decidedly weird. Then she saw the smoke, but it was far to the west. Nothing to concern her and little Walter. Unless someone came along who wanted a closer look at the fire, that was. If that happened, they would surely be neighborly enough to drop her off at the health center on their way to the excitement. She began to sing the James McMurtry song that had been popular last summer. Got as far as, "We roll up the sidewalks 7:45. It's a small town. Can't sell you no beer." Then quit. Her mouth was too dry to sing. She blinked and saw she was on the edge of falling into the ditch, and not even the one she'd been walking next to when she started out. She'd woven all the way across the road, an excellent way to get hit instead of picked up. She looked over her shoulder, hoping for traffic. There was none. The road to Eastchester was empty, the tar not quite hot enough to shimmer. She went back to what she thought of as her side, swaying on her feet now, feeling all jelly-legged.
Drunken sailor, she thought. What do you do with a drunken sailor early in the morning?
But it wasn't morning, it was afternoon. She had slept the clock round, and when she looked down, she saw that the crotch of her sweats had turned purple. Just like the underpants she'd been wearing earlier.
That won't come out, and I only have two other pairs of sweats that fit me.
Then she remembered one of those had a big old hole in the seat, and began to cry. The tears felt cool on her hot cheeks.
It's all right, little Walter, she said. Dr. Haskell's going to fix us up just fine. Fine as paint. Good as...
Then a black rose began to bloom in front of her eyes, and the last of her strength left her legs. Sammy felt it go, running out of her muscles like water. She went down, holding onto one final thought.
On your side, on your side. Don't squash the baby.
That much she managed. She lay sprawled on the shoulder of Motton Road, unmoving in the hazy July-ish sun. Little Walter awoke and began to cry. He tried to struggle out of the papoose and couldn't. Sammy had snapped him in carefully, and he was pinned. Little Walter began to cry harder. A fly settled on his forehead, sampled the blood oozing through the cartoon images of SpongeBob and Patrick, then flew off, possibly to report this taste treat at Fly HQ and summon reinforcements. Grasshoppers reed in the grass. The town whistle honked. Little Walter, trapped with his unconscious mother, wailed for a while in the heat, then gave up and lay silent, looking around listlessly as sweat rolled out of his fine hair in large, clear drops. 6. Standing beside the Globe Theater's boarded-up box office and under its sagging marquee, the Globe had gone out of business 5 years before. Barbie had a good view of both the town hall and the police station. His good buddy Junior was sitting on the cop shop steps, massaging his temples as if the rhythmic whoop of the whistle hurt his head. Al Timmons came out of the town hall and jogged down to the street. He was wearing his gray janitor's fatigues, but there was a pair of binoculars hanging from a strap around his neck and an Indian pump on his back, empty of water from the ease with which he was carrying it. Barbie guessed Al had blown the fire whistle.
Go away, Al, Barbie thought. How about it?
Half a dozen trucks rolled up the street. The first two were pickups, the third a panel job. All three lead vehicles were painted a yellow so bright it almost screamed. The pickups had Burpee's department store decaled on the doors. The panel truck's box bore the legendary slogan, "Meet me for Slurpees at Burpee's." Romeo himself was in the lead truck. His hair was its usual daddy cool marvel of sweeps and spirals. Brenda Perkins was riding shotgun. In the pickup's bed were shovels, hoses, and a brand new sump pump still plastered with the manufacturer's stickers. Romeo stopped beside Al Timmons. "Jump in the back, partner," he said, and Al did. Barbie withdrew as far as he could into the shadow of the deserted theater's marquee. He didn't want to be drafted to help fight the fire out on Little Bitch Road. He had business right here in town. Junior hadn't moved from the PD steps, but he was still rubbing his temples and holding his head. Barbie waited for the trucks to disappear, then hurried across the street. Junior didn't look up, and a moment later he was hidden from Barbie's view by the ivy-covered bulk of the town hall. Barbie went up the steps and paused to read the sign on the message board. Town meeting Thursday, 7 p.m. if crisis is not resolved. He thought of Julia saying, until you've heard Big Jim Rennie's stump speech, don't sell him short. He might get a chance Thursday night. Certainly Rennie would make his pitch to stay in control of the situation. And for more power, Julia's voice spoke up in his head. He'll want that too, of course, for the good of the town. The town hall had been built of quarried stone 160 years before, and the vestibule was cool and dim. The generator was off. No need to run it with no one here. Except someone was, in the main meeting hall. Barbie heard voices, two of them belonging to children. The tall oak doors were standing ajar. He looked in and saw a skinny man with a lot of graying hair sitting up front at the selectman's table. Opposite him was a pretty little girl of about 10.
They had a checkerboard between them. The long hair had his chin propped on one hand, studying his next move. Down below, in the aisle between the benches, a young woman was playing leapfrog with a boy of 4 or 5. The checker players were studious. The young woman and the boy were laughing. Barbie started to withdraw, but too late, the young woman looked up. Hi, hello? She picked up the boy and came toward him. The checker players looked up too, so much for stealth. The young woman was holding out the hand she wasn't using to support the little boy's bottom. I'm Carolyn Sturges. That gentleman is my friend, Thurston Marshall. The little guy is Aiden Appleton. Say hi, Aiden.
Hi,
Aiden said in a small voice, and then plugged his thumb into his mouth. He looked at Barbie with eyes that were round and blue and mildly curious. The girl ran up the aisle to stand beside Carolyn Sturges. The long hair followed more slowly. He looked tired and shaken.
I'm Alice Rachel Appleton, she said. Aiden's big sister. Take your thumb out of your mouth, Aide.
Aide didn't. Well, it's nice to meet all of you, Barbie said. He didn't tell them his own name. In fact, he sort of wished he were wearing a fake mustache. But this still might be all right. He was almost positive these people were out-of-towners.
Are you a town official? Thurston Marshall asked. If you're a town official, I wish to lodge a complaint.
I'm just the janitor, Barbie said, then remembered they had almost certainly seen Al Timmons leave. Hell, probably had a conversation with him. The other janitor. You must have met Al.
I want my mother, Aiden Appleton said. I miss her bad.
We met him, Carolyn Sturges said. He claims the government shot some missiles at whatever is holding us in, and all they did was bounce off and start a fire.
That's true, Barbie said, and before he could say more, Marshall weighed in again.
I want to lodge a complaint. In fact, I want to lay a charge. I was assaulted by a so-called police officer. He punched me in the stomach. I had my gallbladder out a few years ago, and I'm afraid I may have internal injuries. Also, Carolyn was verbally abused. She was called a name that degraded her, sexually.
Carolyn laid a hand on his arm.
Before we go making any charges, Thurs, you want to remember we had D-O-P-E.
Dope, Alice said at once. Our mom smokes marijuana sometimes because it helps when she's having her P-E-R-I-O-D.
Oh, Carolyn said. Right. Her smile was wan. Marshall drew himself up to his full height.
Possession of marijuana is a misdemeanor, he said. What they did to me was felony assault, and it hurts terribly.
Carolyn gave him a look in which affection was mingled with exasperation. Barbie suddenly understood how it was between them. Sexy May had met erudite November, and now they were stuck with each other, refugees in the New England version of No Exit.
Thurs, I'm not sure that misdemeanor idea would fly in court.
She smiled apologetically at Barbie.
We had quite a lot. They took it.
Maybe they'll smoke up the evidence, Barbie said. She laughed at this. Her graying boyfriend did not. His bushy brows had drawn together.
All the same, I plan to lodge a complaint.
I'd wait, Barbie said. The situation here, well, let's just say that a punch in the gut isn't going to be considered that big a deal as long as we're still under the dome.
I consider it a big deal, my young janitor friend.
The young woman now looked more exasperated than affectionate.
Thurs, the good side of that is that nobody's going to make a big deal out of some pot, either, Barbie said.
Maybe it's a push, as the gamblers say. How'd you come by the kiddos?
The cops we ran into at Thurston's cabin saw us at the restaurant, Carolyn said. The woman who runs it said they were closed until supper, but she took pity on us when we said we were from Massachusetts. She gave us sandwiches and coffee.
She gave us peanut butter and jelly and coffee, Thurston corrected. There was no choice, not even tuna fish. I told her peanut butter sticks to my upper plate, but she said they were on rationing. Isn't that about the craziest thing you've ever heard?
Barbie did think it was crazy, but since it had also been his idea, he said nothing.
When I saw the cops come in, I was ready for more trouble, Carolyn said. But Aide and Alice seemed to have mellowed them out.
Thurston snorted.
Not so mellow. They apologized, or did I miss that part?
Carolyn sighed, then turned back to Barbie.
They said maybe the pastor of the Congregational Church could find the four of us an empty house to live in until this is over. I guess we're going to be foster parents, at least for a while.
She stroked the boy's hair.
Thurston Marshall looked less than pleased at the prospect of becoming a foster parent, but he put an arm around the girl's shoulders. And Barbie liked him for that.
One cop was Junior, Alice said. He's nice. Also, a fox. Frankie isn't as good-looking, but he was nice, too. He gave us a Milky Way bar. Mom says we're not supposed to take candy from strangers, but...
She shrugged, to indicate things had changed. In fact, she and Carolyn seemed to understand much more clearly than Thurston.
They weren't nice before, Thurston said. They weren't nice when they were punching me in the stomach, Carol.
You have to take the bitter with the sweet, Alice said philosophically. That's what my mother says.
Carolyn laughed. Barbie joined in, and after a moment, so did Marshall. Although he held his stomach while he did it, and looked at his young girlfriend with a certain reproach. I went up the street and knocked on the church door, Carolyn said. There was no answer, so I went in. The door was unlocked, but there was nobody there. Do you have any idea when the pastor will be back?
Barbie shook his head.
I'd take your checkerboard and go on up to the parsonage if I were you. It's around back. You're looking for a woman named Piper Libby.
Cherchez la femme, Thurston said.
Barbie shrugged, then nodded. She's good people, and God knows there are empty houses in the mill. You could almost have your pick, and you'll probably find supplies in the pantry wherever you go. This made him think of the fallout shelter again. Alice, meanwhile, had grabbed the checkers, which she stuffed in her pockets, and the board, which she carried.
Mr. Marshall's beat me every game so far, she told Barbie. He says it's patronizing to let kids win just because they're kids. But I'm getting better, aren't I, Mr. Marshall?
She smiled up at him. Thurston Marshall smiled back. Barbie thought this unlikely quartet might be okay.
Youth must be served, Alice, my dear, he said, but not immediately.
I want Mommy, Aiden said morosely.
If there was only a way to get in touch with her, Carolyn said. Alice, you're sure you don't remember her email address? And to Barbie she said, Mom left her cell phone at the cabin, so that's no good.
She's a Hotmail, Alice said. That's all I know. Sometimes she says she used to be a hot female, but Daddy took care of that.
Carolyn was looking at her elderly boyfriend. Blow this pop shop?
Yes, we may as well repair to the parsonage and hope the lady comes back soon from whatever errand of mercy she happens to be on.
Parsonage might be unlocked, too, Barbie said. If it isn't, try under the doormat.
I wouldn't presume,
he said. I would, Carolyn said, and giggled. The sound made the little boy smile.
Presume,
Alice Appleton cried, and went flying up the center aisle with her arms outstretched and the checkerboard flapping from one hand.
Presume, presume, come on, you guys, let's presume.
Thurston sighed and started after her.
If you break the checkerboard, Alice, you'll never beat me.
Yes, I will, 'cause youth must be served, she called back over her shoulder. Besides, we could tape it together, come on.
Aiden wriggled impatiently in Carolyn's arms. She set him down to chase after his sister. Carolyn held out her hand.
Thank you, Mr.
More than welcome, Barbie said, shaking with her. Then he turned to Thurston. The man had the fish belly grip Barbie associated with guys whose intelligence to exercise ratio was out of whack. They started out after the kids. At the double doors, Thurston Marshall looked back. A shaft of hazy sun from one of the high windows struck across his face, making him look older than he was, making him look 80.
I edited the current issue of Plowshares, he said.
His voice quivered with indignation and sorrow.
That is a very good literary magazine, one of the best in the country. They had no right to punch me in the stomach or laugh at me.
No, Barbie said, of course not. Take good care of those kids. We will, Carolyn said. She took the man's arm and squeezed it. Come on, Thurse. Barbie waited until he heard the outer door close, then went in search of the stairs leading to the town hall, conference room, and kitchen. Julia had said the fallout shelter was half a flight down from there. 7. Piper's first thought was that someone had left a bag of garbage beside the road. Then she got a little closer and saw it was a body. She pulled over and scrambled out the car so fast she went to one knee, scraping it. When she got up, she saw it wasn't one body, but two, a woman and a toddler. The child, at least, was alive, waving its arms feebly. She ran to them and turned the woman onto her back. She was young and vaguely familiar, but not a member of Piper's congregation. Her cheek and brow were badly bruised. Piper freed the child from the carrier, and when she held him against her and stroked his sweaty hair, he began to cry hoarsely. The woman's eyes fluttered open at the sound, and Piper saw that her pants were soaked with blood.
"The Walter,"
the woman croaked, which Piper misheard. "Don't worry, there's water in the car. Lie still. I've got your baby. He's okay." Not knowing if he was or not. "I'll take care of him."
"The Walter,"
the woman said again, and closed her eyes. Piper ran back to her car with her heart beating hard enough for her to feel it in her eyeballs. Her tongue tasted coppery. "God help me," she prayed. I could think of nothing else, so she thought it again. "God, oh God, help me, help that woman." The Subaru had air conditioning, but she hadn't been using it in spite of the heat of the day. Rarely did. Her understanding was that it wasn't very eco-friendly, but she turned it on now, full blast. She laid the baby on the back seat, rolled up the windows, closed the doors, started back toward the young woman lying in the dust, then was struck by a terrible thought. What if the baby managed to climb over the seat, pushed the wrong button, and locked her out? "God, I'm so stupid. The worst minister in the world when a real crisis comes. Help me not to be so stupid." She rushed back, opened the driver's door again, looked over the seat, and saw the boy still lying where she had put him, but now sucking his thumb. His eyes went to her briefly, then looked up at the ceiling as if he saw something interesting there. Mental cartoons, maybe. He had sweated right through the little t-shirt beneath his overall. Piper twisted the electronic key fob back and forth in her fist until it broke free of the key ring. Then she ran back to the woman, who was trying to sit up. "Don't," Piper said, kneeling beside her and putting an arm around her. "I don't think you should."
"No, Walter,"
the woman croaked. "Shit, I forgot the water. God, why did you let me forget the water?" Now the woman was trying to struggle to her feet. Piper didn't like this idea, which ran counter to everything she knew of first aid, but what other option was there? The road was deserted, and she couldn't leave her out in the blaring sun. That would be worse, and more of it. So, instead of pushing her back down, Piper helped her to stand. "Slow," she said, now holding the woman around the waist and guiding her staggering steps as best she could. "Slow and easy does it. Slow and easy wins the race. It's cool in the car, and there's water."
"Lil Walter,"
the woman swayed, steadied, then tried to move a little faster. "Water," Piper said, "right. Then I'm taking you to the hospital."
"Hell, sender."
This Piper did understand, and she shook her head firmly. "No way. You're going straight to the hospital, you and your baby both."
"Lil Walter,"
the woman whispered. She stood swaying, head down, hair hanging in her face, while Piper opened the passenger door and then eased her inside. Piper got the bottle of Poland Spring out of the center console and took off the cap. The woman snatched it from her before Piper could offer it and drank greedily, water overspilling the neck and dripping off her chin to darken the top of her t-shirt. "What's your name?" Piper asked.
"Sammy Bushy."
And then even as her stomach cramped from the water, that black rose began to open in front of Sammy's eyes again. The bottle dropped out of her hand and fell to the floor mat, gurgling, as she passed out. Piper drove as fast as she could, which was pretty fast, since Motton Road remained deserted. But when she got to the hospital, she discovered that Dr. Haskell had died the day before and the physician's assistant, Everett, was not there. Sammy was examined and admitted by that famed medical expert, Dougie Twitchell. 8. While Ginny was trying to stop Sammy Bushy's vaginal bleeding, and Twitch was giving the badly dehydrated little Walter IV fluids, Rusty Everett was sitting quietly on a park bench at the town hall edge of the common. The bench was beneath the spreading arms of a tall blue spruce, and he thought he was in shade deep enough to render him effectively invisible, as long as he didn't move around much, that was. There were interesting things to look at. He had planned to go directly to the storage building behind the town hall. Twitch had called it a shed, but the long wooden building which also housed the mill's 4 snowplows was actually quite a bit grander than that. and checked the propane situation there, but then one of the police cars pulled up, with Frankie de Lesseps at the wheel. Junior Rennie had emerged from the passenger side. The two had spoken for a moment or two, then de Lesseps had driven away. Junior went up the PD steps, but instead of going in, he sat down there, rubbing his temples as if he had a headache. Rusty decided to wait. He didn't want to be seen checking up on the town's energy supply, especially not by the second selectman's son. At one point, Junior took his cell phone out of his pocket, flipped it open, listened, said something, listened some more, said something else, then flipped it closed again. He went back to rubbing his temples. Dr. Haskell had said something about that young man. Migraine headaches, was it? It certainly looked like a migraine. It wasn't just the temple rubbing. It was the way he was keeping his head down. Trying to minimize the glare, Rusty thought. Must have left his Imitrex or Zomig home. Assuming Haskell prescribed it, that is. Rusty had half risen, meaning to cut across Commonwealth Lane to the rear of the town hall, Junior clearly not being at his most observant. But then he spotted someone else and sat down again. Dale Barbara, the short-order cook who had reputedly been elevated to the rank of colonel by the president himself, according to some, was standing beneath the marquee of the Globe, even deeper in the shadows than Rusty was himself. And Barbara also appeared to be keeping an eye on young Mr. Rennie. Interesting. Barbara apparently came to the conclusion that Rusty had already drawn. Junior wasn't watching, but waiting, possibly for someone to pick him up. Barbara hustled across the street and, once he was blocked from Junior's potential view by the town hall itself, paused to scan the message board out front. Then he went inside. Rusty decided to sit where he was a while longer. It was nice under the tree, and he was curious about whom Junior might be waiting for. People were still straggling back from dippers. Some would have stayed much longer had the booze been flowing. Most of them, like the young man sitting on the steps over yonder, had their heads down, not in pain, Rusty surmised, but in dejection. Or maybe they were the same. It was certainly a point to ponder. Now here came a boxy black gas gobbler Rusty knew well. Big Jim Rennie's Hummer. It honked impatiently at a trio of townsfolk who were walking in the street, shunting them aside like sheep. The Hummer pulled in at the PD. Junior looked up but didn't stand up. The doors opened. Andy Sanders got out from behind the wheel, Rennie from the passenger side. Rennie, allowing Sanders to drive his beloved Black Pearl. Sitting on his bench, Rusty raised his eyebrows. He didn't think he'd ever seen anyone but Big Jim himself behind the wheel of that monstrosity. Maybe he's decided to promote Andy from dog's body to chauffeur, he thought. But when he watched Big Jim mount the steps to where his son still sat, he changed his mind. Like most veteran medicos, Rusty was a pretty fair long-distance diagnostician. He would never have based a course of treatment on it, but you could tell a man who'd had a hip replacement 6 months ago from one currently suffering with hemorrhoids simply by the way he walked. You could tell a neck strain by the way a woman would turn her whole body instead of just looking back over her shoulder. You could tell a kid who'd picked up a good crop of lice at summer camp by the way he kept scratching his head. Big Jim held his arm against the upper slope of his considerable gut as he went up the steps. The classic body language of a man who has recently suffered either a shoulder strain, an upper arm strain, or both. Not so surprising that Sanders had been delegated to pilot the beast after all. The three of them talked. Junior didn't get up, but Sanders sat down beside him, rummaged in his pocket, and brought out something that twinkled in the hazy afternoon sunlight. Rusty's eyes were good, but he was at least 50 yards too far away to make out what the object might have been. Either glass or metal. That was all he could tell for sure. Junior put it in his pocket, then the three of them talked some more. Rennie gestured to the Hummer. He did it with his good arm, and Junior shook his head. Then Sanders pointed to the Hummer. Junior declined it again, dropped his head, and went back to working his temples. The two men looked at each other, Sanders craning his neck because he was still sitting on the steps, and in Big Jim's shadow, which Rusty thought appropriate. Big Jim shrugged and opened his hands, a what-can-you-do gesture. Sanders stood up and the two men went into the PD building, Big Jim pausing long enough to pat his son's shoulder, Junior gave no response to that. He went on sitting where he was, as if he intended to sit out the age. Sanders played doorman for Big Jim, ushering him inside before following. The two selectmen had no more than left the scene when a quartet came out of the town hall. An oldish gent, a young woman, a girl, and a boy. The girl was holding the boy's hand and carrying a checkerboard. The boy looked almost as disconsolate as Junior, Rusty thought, and damned if he wasn't also rubbing one temple with his free hand. The four of them cut across Calm Lane, then passed directly in front of Rusty's bench.
"Hello," the little girl said brightly. "I'm Alice. This is Aiden."
"We're going to live at the Passionage,"
the little boy named Aiden said dourly. He was still rubbing his temple, and he looked very pale. "That will be exciting," Rusty said. "Sometimes I wish I lived at a Passionage." The man and woman caught up with the kids. They were holding hands. Father and daughter, Rusty surmised. "Actually, we just want to talk to the Reverend Libby," the woman said. "You wouldn't know if she's back yet, would you?" "No idea," Rusty said.
"Well, we'll just go over and wait
at the Passionage." She smiled up at the older man when she said this. Rusty decided they might not be father and daughter, after all.
"That's what the janitor said to do."
"Al Timmons?" Rusty had seen Al hop into the back of a Burpee's department store truck.
"No, the other one," the older man said. "He said the Reverend might be able to help us with lodgings."
Rusty nodded. "Was his name Dale?"
"I don't think he actually gave us his name," the woman said.
"Come on!"
The boy let go of his sister's hand and tugged at the woman's instead.
"I want to play that other game you said."
But he sounded more querulous than eager. Mild shock, maybe, or some physical ailment. If the latter, Rusty hoped it was only a cold. The last thing the mill needed right now was an outbreak of flu.
"They've misplaced their mother, at least temporarily," the woman said in a low voice. "We're taking care of them."
"Good for you," Rusty said, and meant it. "Son, does your head hurt?"
"No."
"Sore throat?"
"No,"
the boy named Aiden said. His solemn eyes studied Rusty.
"Know what? If we don't trick-or-treat this year, I don't even care."
"Aiden Appleton," Alice cried, sounding shocked out of her shoes.
Rusty jerked a little on the bench. He couldn't help it. Then he smiled.
"No? Why is that?"
"Because Mommy takes us around and Mommy went for supplies."
"He means supplies," the girl named Alice said indulgently.
"She went for whoops," Aiden said.
He looked like a little old man. A little old worried man.
"I'd be scared to go Halloweenin' without Mommy."
"Come on, Caro," the man said.
"We ought to..."
Rusty rose from the bench. "Could I speak to you for a minute, ma'am? Just a step or two over here." Caro looked puzzled and wary, but stepped with him to the side of the blue spruce. "Has the boy exhibited any seizure activity?" Rusty asked. "That might include suddenly stopping what he's doing, you know, just standing still for a while, or a fixed stare, smacking of the lips."
"Nothing like that," the man said, joining them.
"No," Caro agreed, but she looked frightened. The man saw it and turned an impressive frown on Rusty.
"Are you a doctor?"
"Physician's assistant, I thought maybe..."
"Well, I'm sure we appreciate your concern, Mr....
Eric Everett, call me Rusty."
"We appreciate your concern, Mr. Everett, but I believe it's misplaced. Bear in mind that these children are without their mother."
"And they spent two nights alone without much to eat," Caro added. "They were trying to make it to town on their own when those two... officers," she wrinkled her nose as if the word had a bad smell, "found them." Rusty nodded. "That could explain it, I guess. Although the little girl seems fine. Children react differently, and we better go. They're getting away from us, Thurse." Alice and Aiden were running across the park, kicking up colorful bursts of fallen leaves, Alice flapping the checkerboard and yelling, "Passionage, Passionage," at the top of her lungs. The boy was keeping up with her stride for stride and also yelling. Kid had a momentary fugue, that's all, Rusty thought. The rest was coincidence, not even that. What American kid isn't thinking of Halloween during the last half of October? One thing was sure. If these people were asked later, they would remember exactly where and when they had seen Eric Rusty Everett. So much for stealth. The gray-haired man raised his voice.
Children, slow down.
The young woman considered Rusty, then put out her hand.
Thank you for your concern, Mr. Everett. Rusty.
Probably over-concern, occupational hazard. You're totally forgiven. This has been the craziest weekend in the history of the world. Chalk it up to that.
You bet. And if you need me, check the hospital or the health center.
He pointed in the direction of Kathy Russell, which would be visible through the trees once the rest of the leaves fell. If they fell.
Or this bench, she said, still smiling.
Or this bench.
Right.
Also smiling.
Caro!
Thirst sounded impatient. Come on! She gave Rusty a little wave, no more than a twiddle of the fingertips, then ran after the others. She ran lightly, gracefully. Rusty wondered if Thirst knew that girls who could run lightly and gracefully almost always ran away from their elderly lovers sooner or later. Maybe he did. Maybe it had happened to him before.
Rusty watched them cut across the common toward the spire of the Congo Church. Eventually the trees screened them from sight. When he looked back at the PD building, Junior Rennie was gone. Rusty sat where he was for a moment or two, drumming his fingers on his thighs. Then he came to a decision and stood up, checking the town storage shed for the hospital's missing propane tanks could wait. He was more curious about what the mill's one and only army officer was doing in the town hall.
9. What Barbie was doing as Rusty crossed Calm Lane to the town hall was whistling appreciatively through his teeth. The fallout shelter was as long as an Amtrak dining car, and the shelves were fully stocked with canned goods. Most looked pretty fishy. Stacks of sardines, ranks of salmon, and a lot of something called Snow's Clam Fryettes, which Barbie sincerely hoped he would never have to sample. There were boxes of dry goods, including many large plastic canisters marked rice, wheat, powdered milk, and sugar. There were stacked flats of bottles labeled drinking water. He counted 10 large cartons of U.S. government surplus crackers. 2 more were labeled U.S. government surplus chocolate bars. On the wall above these was a yellowing sign reading, 700 calories a day keeps hunger at bay. Dream on, Barbie muttered. There was a door at the far end. He opened it on Stygian blackness, felt around, found a light switch. Another room, not quite so big, but still large. It looked old and disused, not dirty. Al Timmons at least must know about it, because someone had been dusting the shelves and dry mopping the floors. But neglected, for sure. The stored water was in glass bottles, and he hadn't seen any of those since a brief stint in Saudi. The second room contained a dozen folded cots, plus plain blue blankets and mattresses that had been zipped into clear plastic covers, pending use. There were more supplies, including half a dozen cardboard canisters labeled sanitation kit, and another dozen marked air masks. There was a small auxiliary generator that could supply minimal power. It was running. Must have started up when he turned on the lights. Flanking the little Jenny were 2 shelves. On one was a radio that looked as if it might have been new around the time C.W. McCall's novelty song Convoy had been a hit. On the other shelf were 2 hot plates and a metal box painted bright yellow. The logo on the side was from the days when CD stood for something other than compact disc. It was what he had come to find. Barbie picked it up, then almost dropped it. It was heavy. On the front was a gauge labeled counts per second. When you turned the instrument on and pointed the sensor at something, the needle might stay in the green, rise to the yellow center of the dial, or go over into the red. That, Barbie assumed, would not be good. He turned it on. The little power lamp stayed dark, and the needle lay quiet against zero.
Battery's dead, someone said from behind him.
Barbie almost jumped out of his skin. He looked around and saw a tall, heavy-set man with blonde hair standing in the doorway between the 2 rooms. For a moment, the name eluded him, although the guy was at the restaurant most Sunday mornings, sometimes with his wife, always with his 2 little girls. Then it came to him.
Rusty Evers, right?
Close. It's Everett. The newcomer held out his hand. A little warily, Barbie walked over and shook it.
Saw you come in,
And that, he nodded to the Geiger counter, is probably not a bad idea. Something must be keeping it in place. He didn't say what he meant by it, and didn't need to. Glad you approve. You almost scared me into a goddamn heart attack. But you could take care of that, I guess. You're a doc, right? PA, Rusty said. That means... I know what it means. Okay, you win the waterless cookware. Rusty pointed at the Geiger counter. That thing probably takes a 6-volt dry cell. I'm pretty sure I saw some at Burpee's. Less sure anybody's there right now, so... Maybe a little more recce? What exactly would we be reconning? The supply shed out back. And we'd want to do that because... That depends on what we find. If it's what we lost up at the hospital, you and I might exchange a little information. Want to share on what you lost? Propane, brother. Barbie considered this. What the hell? Let's take a look. 10. Junior stood at the foot of the rickety stairs leading up the side of Sanders' hometown drug, wondering if he could possibly climb them with his head aching the way it was. Maybe. Probably. On the other hand, he thought he might get halfway up and his skull would pop like a New Year's Eve noisemaker. The spot was back in front of his eye, jigging and jagging with his heartbeat. But it was no longer white. It had turned bright red. I'd be okay, in the dark, he thought, in the pantry, with my girlfriends. If this went right, he could go there. Right now, the pantry of the McCain house on Prestille Street seemed like the most desirable place on earth. Of course, Coggins was there too, but so what? Junior could always push that gospel-shouting asshole to one side. And Coggins had to stay hidden, at least for the time being. Junior had no interest in protecting his father, and was neither surprised nor dismayed at what his old man had done. Junior had always known Big Jim Rennie had murder in him. But he did have an interest in fixing Dale Barbara's little red wagon. If we handle this right, we can do more than get him out of the way, Big Jim had said that morning. We can use him to unify the town in the face of this crisis. And that cotton-picking newspaper woman. I have an idea about her, too. He had laid a warm and hammy hand on his son's shoulder. We're a team, son. Maybe not forever, but for the time being, they were pulling the same plow. And they would take care of Barbie. It had even occurred to Junior that Barbie was responsible for his headaches. If Barbie really had been overseas, Iraq was the rumor, then he might have come home with some weird Middle Eastern souvenirs. Poison, for instance. Junior had eaten in Sweetbriar Rose many times. Barbara could easily have dropped a little something-something in his food, or his coffee. And if Barbie wasn't working the grill personally, he could have gotten Rose to do it. That cunt was under his spell. Junior mounted the stairs, walking slowly, pausing every 4 steps. His head didn't explode. And when he reached the top, he groped in his pocket for the apartment key Andy Sanders had given him. At first he couldn't find it and thought he might have lost it, but at last his fingers came upon it, hiding under some loose change. He glanced around. A few people were still walking back from Dippers, but no one looked at him up here on the landing outside Barbie's apartment. The key turned in the lock, and he slipped inside. He didn't turn on the lights. Although Sanders' generator was probably sending juice to the apartment. The dimness made the pulsing spot in front of his eye less visible. He looked around curiously. There were books, shelves and shelves of them. Had Barbie been planning on leaving them behind when he blew town? Or had he made arrangements, possibly with Petra Searles, who worked downstairs, to ship them someplace? If so, he'd probably made similar arrangements to ship the rug on the living room floor. Some camel jockey-looking artifact Barbie had probably picked up in the local bazaar when there were no suspects to waterboard or little boys to bugger. He hadn't made arrangements to have the stuff shipped, Junior decided. He hadn't needed to, because he had never planned to leave at all. Once the idea occurred, Junior wondered why he hadn't seen it before. Barbie liked it here, would never leave of his own free will. He was as happy as a maggot in dog puke. Find something he can't talk away, Big Jim had instructed, something that can only be his, do you understand me? What do you think I am, Dad, stupid? Junior thought now. If I'm stupid, how come it was me who saved your ass last night? But his father had a mighty swing on him when he got his mat on. That much was undeniable. He had never slapped or spanked Junior as a child, something Junior had always attributed to his late mother's ameliorating influence. Now he suspected it was because his father understood, deep in his heart, that once he started, he might not be able to stop.
"Like father, like son," Junior said, and giggled.
It hurt his head, but he giggled anyway. What was that old saying about laughter being the best medicine? He went into Barbie's bedroom, saw the bed was neatly made, and thought briefly of how wonderful it would be to take a big shit right in the middle of it. Yes, and then wipe himself with the pillowcase. How would you like that, Barbie? He went to the dresser instead. 3 or 4 pairs of jeans in the top drawer, plus 2 pairs of khaki shorts. Under the shorts was a cell phone, and for a moment he thought that was what he wanted. But no. It was a discount store special, what the kids at college called a burner or a throwaway. Barbie could always say it wasn't his. There were 6 pairs of skivvies and another 4 or 5 pairs of plain white athletic socks in the 2nd drawer. Nothing at all in the 3rd drawer. He looked under the bed, his head thudding and whamming. Not better after all, it seemed. And nothing under there, not even dust kitties. Barbie was a neatnik. Junior considered taking the Imitrex in his watch pocket, but didn't. He'd taken 2 already with absolutely no effect except for the metallic aftertaste in the back of his throat. He knew what medicine he needed. The dark pantry on Prestile Street. And the company of his girlfriends. Meantime, he was here. And there had to be something.
"Something," he whispered. "Gotta have a little something, something."
He started back to the living room, wiping water from the corner of his throbbing left eye, not noticing it was tinged with blood. Then stopped, struck by an idea. He returned to the dresser, opened the sock and underwear drawer again. The socks were bald. When he was in high school, Junior had sometimes hidden a little weed or a couple of uppers in his balled-up socks. Once, one of Adriat Nadeau's thongs. Socks were a good hiding place. He took out the neatly made bundles one at a time, feeling them up. He hit pay dirt on the 3rd ball, something that felt like a flat piece of metal. No, 2 of them. He unrolled the socks and shook the heavy one over the top of the dresser. What fell out were Dale Barbara's dog tags. And in spite of his terrible headache, Junior smiled.
"In the frame, Barbie," he thought. "You are in the fucking frame."
11. On the Tarker's Mill side of Little Bitch Road, the fires set by the Fast Hawk missiles were still raging, but would be out by dark. Fire departments from 4 towns, augmented by a mixed detachment of Marine and Army grunts, were working on it, and gaining. It would have been out even sooner, Brenda Perkins judged, if the firefighters over there hadn't had a brisk wind to contend with. On the mill side, they'd had no such problem. It was a blessing today. Later on, it might be a curse. There was no way to know. Brenda wasn't going to let the question bother her this afternoon because she felt good. If someone had asked her this morning when she thought she might feel good again, Brenda would have said maybe next year, maybe never. And she was wise enough to know this feeling probably wouldn't last. 90 minutes of hard exercise had a lot to do with it. Exercise released endorphins, whether the exercise was jogging or pounding out brush fires with the flat of a spade. But this was more than endorphins. It was being in charge of a job that was important, one that she could do. Other volunteers had come to the smoke. 14 men and 3 women stood on either side of Little Bitch, some still holding the spades and rubber mats they'd been using to put out the creeping flames, some with the Indian pumps they'd been wearing on their backs, now unslung and sitting on the unpaved hardpack of the road. Al Timmons, Johnny Carver, and Nell Toomey were coiling hoses and tossing them into the back of the burpees truck. Tommy Anderson from Dippers and Lissa Jameson, a little new agey but also as strong as a horse, were carrying the sump pump they'd used to draw water from Little Bitch Creek to one of the other trucks. Brenda heard laughter and realized she wasn't the only one currently enjoying an endorphin rush. The brush on both sides of the road was blackened and still smoldering, and several trees had gone up, but that was all. The dome had blocked the wind and had helped them in another way as well, partially damming the creek and turning the area on this side into a marsh in progress. The fire on the other side was a different story. The men fighting it over there were shimmering wraiths, seen through the heat and accumulating soot on the dome. Romeo Burpee sauntered up to her. He was holding a soaked broom in one hand and a rubber floor mat in the other. The price tag was still clinging to the underside of the mat. The words on it were charred but readable. "Every day is sale day at Burpee's." He dropped it and stuck out a grimy hand. Brenda was surprised, but willing. She shook firmly. "What's that for, Romy?"
"For you doing one damn fine job out here," he said.
She laughed, embarrassed but pleased.
"Anybody could have done it, given the conditions. It was only a contact fire, and the ground's so squelchy it probably would have put itself out by sunset."
"Maybe,"
he said, then pointed through the trees to a raggedy clearing with a tumble-down rock wall meandering across it.
"Or maybe it would have gotten into that high grass, then the trees on the other side, and then Katie bar the door. It could have burned for a week or a month, especially with no damn fire department."
He turned his head aside and spat.
"Even without wind, a fire will burn if it gets a foothold. They got mine fires down south that have burned for 20-30 years. I read it in National Geographic. No wind underground. And how do we know a good wind won't come up? We don't know jack about what that thing does or don't do."
They both looked toward the dome. The soot and ash had rendered it visible, sort of, to a height of almost 100 feet. It had also dimmed their view of the Tarker's side, and Brenda didn't like that. It wasn't anything she wanted to consider deeply. Not when it might rob some of her good feelings about the afternoon's work, but no, she didn't like it at all. It made her think of last night's weird, smeary sunset.
"Dale Barbara needs to call his friend in Washington," she said. "Tell him, when they get the fire out on their side, they have to hose that whatever it is off. We can't do it from our side."
"Good idea," Romeo said, but something else was on his mind. "Do you recognize anything about your crew, ma'am? Because I sure do."
Brenda looked startled. "They're not my crew."
"Oh, yes they are," he said. "You were the one given orders that makes them your crew. You see any cops?"
She took a look.
"Not a one," Romeo said. "Not Randolph, not Henry Morrison, not Freddie Denton or Rupe Libby, not Georgie Frederick. None of the new ones either. Those kids.
They're probably busy with..."
She trailed off.
Romeo nodded. "Right. Busy with what? You don't know, and neither do I. But whatever they're busy with, I'm not sure I like it. Or think it's worth being busy with. There's going to be a town meeting Thursday night, and if this is still going on, I think there should be some changes."
He paused.
"I could be getting out of my place here, but I think maybe you ought to stand for Chief of Fire and Police."
Brenda considered it, considered the file she had found marked Vader, then shook her head slowly.
"It's too soon for anything like that."
"What about just fire, Chief? How about that one?"
The Lewiston on Parl coming on stronger in his voice now. Brenda looked around at the smoldering brush and charred trashwood trees. Ugly, granted, like something out of a World War I battlefield photo, but no longer dangerous. The people who had shown up here had seen to that. The crew. Her crew. She smiled.
"That I might consider."
12. The first time Ginny Tomlinson came down the hospital hallway, she was running, responding to a loud beeping that sounded like bad news. And Piper didn't have a chance to speak to her. Didn't even try. She had been in the waiting room long enough to get the picture. 3 people, 2 nurses, and a teenage candy striper named Gina Buffalino, in charge of an entire hospital. They were coping, but barely. When Ginny came back, she was walking slowly. Her shoulders were slumped. A medical chart dangled from one hand.
"Ginny?" Piper asked.
"Okay." Piper thought Ginny might snap at her, but she offered a tired smile instead of a snarl, and sat down next to her.
"Fine, just tired." She paused. "Also, Ed Carty just died."
Piper took her hand.
"I am very sorry to hear that."
Ginny squeezed her fingers.
Don't be. You know how women talk about having babies? This one had an easy delivery. This one had it hard.
Piper nodded.
Death is like that, too. Mr. Carty was in labor a long time. But now he's delivered.
To Piper, the idea seemed beautiful. She thought she could use it in a sermon. Except she guessed that people wouldn't want to hear a sermon on death this coming Sunday. Not if the dome was still in place. They sat for a while, Piper trying to think of the best way to ask what she had to ask. In the end, she didn't have to.
She was raped, Ginny said. Probably more than once. I was afraid Twitch was going to have to try his suturing, but I finally got it stopped with a vaginal pack.
She paused.
I was crying. Luckily, the girl was too stoned to notice.
And the baby?
Your basic healthy 18-month-old, but he gave us a scare. He had a mini-seizure. It was probably exposure to the sun. Plus dehydration, hunger, and he has a wound of his own.
Ginny traced a line across her forehead. Twitch came down the hall and joined them. He looked light years from his usual jaunty self.
Did the men who raped her also hurt the baby?
Piper's voice remained calm, but a thin red fissure was opening in her mind. Little Walter, I think he just fell, Twitch said. Sammy said something about the crib collapsing. It wasn't completely coherent, but I'm pretty sure it was an accident. That part, anyway. Piper was looking at him, bemused.
That was what she was saying. I thought it was little water. I'm sure she wanted water, Ginny said, but Sammy's baby really is little. First name, Walter. Second name. They named him after a blues harmonica player, I believe. She and Phil.
Ginny mimed sucking a joint and holding in the smoke.
Oh, Phil was a lot more than a smoke hound, Twitch said. When it came to drugs, Phil Bushy was a multitasker.
Is he dead? Piper asked.
Twitch shrugged.
I haven't seen him around since spring. If he is, good riddance.
Piper looked at him reproachfully. Twitch ducked his head a little.
Sorry, Rev.
He turned to Ginny. Any sign of Rusty?
He needed some time off, she said, and I told him to go. He'll be back soon, I'm sure.
Piper sat between them, outwardly calm. Inside, the red fissure was widening. There was a sour taste in her mouth. She remembered a night when her father had forbidden her to go out to skate scene at the mall because she'd said something smart to her mother. As a teenager, Piper Libby had been an absolute font of smart things to say. She'd gone upstairs, called the friend she had expected to meet, and told that friend, in a perfectly pleasant, perfectly even voice, that something had come up and she wouldn't be able to meet her after all. Next weekend? For sure. Uh-huh, you bet. Have a good time. No, I'm fine. Bye-bye. Then she had trashed her room. She finished by yanking her beloved Oasis poster off the wall and tearing it up. By then she had been crying hoarsely, not in sorrow, but in one of those rages that had blown through her teenage years like Force 5 hurricanes. Her father came up at some point during the festivities and stood in the doorway regarding her. When she finally saw him there, she stared back defiantly, panting, thinking how much she hated him, how much she hated them both. If they were dead, she could go live with her Aunt Ruth in New York. Aunt Ruth knew how to have a good time, not like some people. He had held his hands out to her, open, extended. It had been a somehow humble gesture, one that had crushed her anger and almost crushed her heart.
If you don't control your temper will control you, he had said, and then left her, walking down the hallway with his head bent.
She hadn't slammed the door behind him.
She had closed it, very quietly. That was the year she had made her often vile temper her number one priority. Killing it completely would be killing part of herself, but she thought that if she did not make some fundamental changes, an important part of her would remain 15 for a long, long time. She had begun working to impose control, and mostly she had succeeded. When she felt that control slipping, she would remember what her father had said, and that open-handed gesture, and his slow walk along the upstairs hall of the house she had grown up in. She had spoken at his funeral service 9 years later, saying, "My father told me the most important thing I've ever heard." She hadn't said what that thing was, but her mother had known. She had been sitting in the front pew of the church in which her daughter was now ordained.
For the last 20 years, when she felt the urge to flash out at someone, and often the urge was nearly uncontrollable because people could be so